Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in African Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Esperanza Brizuela Garcia, and today I will be talking to Dr. Mary Wabel about her book, The Politics of Disease Control, Sleeping Sickness in Eastern Africa, 1890 to 1920, published by Ohio University Press in 2019. Dr. Wabel is an assistant professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh. Dr. Wabel, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much. I'm happy to be with you.
I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself, how you became interested in history and African history.
Sure. So I am originally from Southern Illinois, from Carbondale, Illinois, and my interest in history is, it goes back quite far, I think, in terms of how I ended up where I am today. And the interest in African history came along a little bit later. So I started off as an undergraduate in a history core curriculum, which my university offered at the time, in part because I had a really dynamic and really amazing high school history teacher who taught Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States alongside a conventional textbook and had us involved in research as high school students. And so it had always been really interesting and really fun for me to think about historical problems and narratives and so forth, even though I might not have recognized that I was doing that at the time. And I started off as an undergraduate being really interested in history, in part because I loved to write and I was really interested in research. And that came about really organically in a way that was wonderful. But at the time, I thought I was going to be a marine biologist. So I didn't really have any plans to end up as a history researcher in the long run, which is, I think, what happens a lot of the time. And it just settled in for me that that studying history was something that I was good at, and I was interested in pursuing museum studies and public history work at the time. And so that was something I focused on over the course of being an undergraduate. I took one African history course as an undergraduate with Richard Roberts at Stanford University, and that piqued my interest alongside other courses in American history in thinking about race and racism in history and thinking about sort of how we ended up where we are in the late 20th, early 21st century. And I got really interested in the 19th century as a result of all of that. One of the things that was a little bit of a surprising turn, all things considered, was that I pursued a master's degree, again, with the intention of going into public history or museums work, and studied at the University of York in the UK, which had really great public history courses, but also a really robust cultural history program. And it was there that I got this sort of immersion in cultural history and theory, alongside going to these really wonderful museum spaces and thinking about public history with mentors there. And it was in the course of looking for a topic for one of our longer papers that I started talking about this interest I had had as an undergraduate in sort of how and why the 19th century U.S. was what it was, but also something that had come through my courses, which was to see health and illness and ways of talking about disease and ways of talking about cleanliness and sanitation and sexuality were often a way that ideas about racial difference and cultural difference were deployed by people in power. And that was something that was really compelling for me, particularly being from Southern Illinois, which is a place that has a really vexed history of racism and segregation in its different ways. So a tutor at the University of York suggested that I look into some of the work that was going on in one of the welcome units for the history of medicine. And I connected that suggestion to look at the history of medicine and health with a topic I had written about for Richard Roberts in this course as an undergraduate, and came up with a project on the history of segregation as malaria prevention policy in Sierra Leone. And that was my first foray into stitching together African history with this interest in the history of health and the history of medicine and research in a really explicit way. From there, it was not quite off to the races. I actually finished that master's essay, which was really, really a rich experience in studying the history of malaria. But then I returned to the States and started working in the National Archives Center for Legislative Archives, doing the American history work that I had been doing for the most of my academic career. And it wasn't until West Nile virus arrived with great anxiety and fanfare in Washington, D.C. in the early 2000s, that I started to think that maybe it would make sense to pursue my research more formally in the long run. I had no intention of going to study history formally or becoming a professor. I was very steeped in that world in D.C., but I was really struck by the way that newspapers were covering West Nile and mosquito control and mosquito prevention in a way that really harked back to the way that the rhetoric around malaria had been 100 years before. And that really planted the seeds for thinking about the longer arc of the history of tropical medicine and thinking about the longer longer-term implications of imperial thinking, of thinking about colonized spaces for understandings of health and disease transmission, even in the present day. So that settled me much more firmly as someone who was interested in African history with this abiding interest in the history of medicine and health. And that ultimately took me to graduate school at Columbia University, where I studied with Marcia Wright, eminent Africanist Marcia Wright, as well as Nancy Lees Steppen, a historian of medicine and health, as well as many, many other faculty in a variety of different fields, including Greg Mann, who sort of shepherded me through this project.
Excellent. So tell us a little bit about the project in particular. At least we all know, we start with a set of ideas of where you want to go. And then things start to either narrow down or sort of go out of control, depending how the sources and things happen. Tell us a little bit about how you came to write the politics of disease control.
So this was a really interesting, interesting moment for me to reflect on. So I was in graduate school with the intention to look at the history of tropical medicine and understand inter-imperial connections. So I had German as a foreign language coming into graduate school. And so I was interested in looking at how German and French and British and other scientists had interacted prior to the First World War around these big imperial problems. But I was also really interested in thinking about why and how different approaches to disease and health and healing had played out in different spaces. And I got very interested in Eastern Africa as a result of that, in part because I had this research language that I thought I would be able to look at some primary sources with for your graduate school research papers. But I also was just very interested in understanding dynamics in late 19th and early 20th century Eastern Africa. So I was looking through the collected works of Robert Koch, who is one of the most famous scientists that we have in the modern era, I think. And you can talk to medical students and biology students who learn Koch's postulates and know his work sort of from popular history. And there was a translation of some of his work, but then most of the work was in the original German. And I was paging through the collected works of Robert Koch, looking for something about malaria, because I wanted to pick something up from that master's essay. And I happened upon this crazy photograph that I still look at every once in a while and think, this is where it started. But so it was a black and white photograph of an older man with a beard in a pith helmet, really, a sort of imperial caricature, in a pith helmet with another white man standing next to him, kind of crouching next to him in a little kind of military cap. And they were standing over an enormous dead crocodile, just this huge beast. and they were clearly in the middle of some sort of field dissection. And in the background of the picture were sort of reedy vegetation off to the sides, but then directly behind the crocodile were three other men, three African men, who were wearing a sort of traditional Swahili coastal garb, the long kanzu. They looked younger than the other two people, and they were sort of observing, but also sort of posed in the background. And that brought up some really interesting questions for me. First of all, Robert Koch, what are you doing as a bearded elderly man doing a field dissection with a crocodile in Eastern Africa in 1906? What was going on with that? But then also, who were these other people? Their names weren't given in the caption. But when I read the report, you could see the presence of these assistants and auxiliaries who were really interwoven into the processes of knowledge production about sleeping sickness. And that was why Koch was doing what he was doing. He was pursuing a later career interest in tropical medicine and this sort of passion for the trypanosome. And that really got me started in digging on this project. So I became interested in this moment of sort of explosion of research around sleeping sickness, or what became known as human African trypanosomiasis, in the early 20th century. And the attention to sleeping sickness in response to these explosive epidemics that were recognized by Europeans for the first time after around 1901 in the Congo Basin and in the Lake Victoria Basin and elsewhere. And so that got me to working on sleeping sickness and on trypanosomiasis as a way into these histories of power and research and healing. And that was the initial genesis of the book and the focus on sleeping sickness. Sort of how it came to be what it is was another story too.
Well, feel free to tell us, also I think it's also interesting if it has something to do with this. Mm. But I mean, something that was very interesting for me to when I was reading the book is that I think most African history teachers will know that we talk about malaria a lot, mm-hmm. in the context of disease in Africa, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. And we do talk about sleeping sickness, and it's almost like in passing. Mm. And I think one of the things that was really striking when I found your book, and what was very exciting to me when I found your book, is just how big a deal it was, and how we don't tend to make the history books don't tend to make as big a deal of it as it clearly was. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if part of your focus in it, and to some extent you talk a little bit about this in the introduction, but I think it sort of confirms my suspicion that there's not a tremendous historiography on this topic. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about, what's the historiographical scene mm-hmm. and what were you trying to speak to in that historiographical conversation?
Absolutely. So sleeping sickness is a really interesting phenomenon to study historically, but one of the things that's important and that is an abiding concern is that it's not a problem that is gone in the present day. And indeed, I think there is some potential work to be done, and maybe this will come up as we go forward in sort of how much sleeping sickness is discussed in the present day relative to who is affected by it, which is part of my ongoing research. But one of the things that's fascinating about sleeping sickness is something I think that you rightly grabbed onto, which is that at the time in the early 20th century, it is difficult to overstate how pressing it was as an imperial concern and how panicked colonial administrations and imperial scientists were about the implications of this parasitic disease for the future of African colonies in the flybelt. One of the things that was also in the back of some of these scientists' minds was whether sleeping sickness could be spread to other continents. It was understood that it was only in Africa in the early 20th century, but the British always had an eye to the Indian Ocean and the expansion to India. So the anxieties were very, very high. And part of the reason they were high is because this was coming at the latter part of a period where the pathogens were the causative agents for a lot of different diseases were being firmly identified in the laboratory for the first time. And sleeping sickness in the early 20th century was the next big thing in tropical medicine. So in 1897, 98, the mosquito malaria transmission chain was elaborated. The causative pathogen for malaria was identified. That was a major moment in tropical medicine at the time and in knowledge about disease. But trypanosomiasis came up next. So one of the reasons that this was so striking in part was that you had these epidemics that were, from a European perspective, completely novel and completely unknown. Now, that clues us into one of the problems of the historical materials that we have here, because we know that trypanosomiasis had a deep history and a long history in both human and animal populations in Africa. And so when we talk about these early epidemics, we're really looking at a moment where something was changing, but it's difficult to know exactly what the baseline prior to that was because of the nature of descriptions and discussions of disease. But something was changing in the early 20th century. As others have argued, that it had to do with imperial economic imperatives, social disruption, pushing people into environments where they had not been living before, where they were exposed to tsetse fly, and so forth. So the kind of passing reference to sleeping sickness in most modern literature is puzzling because it's an important disease to contend with for Africanists and for specialists in Africa because it's singular to the continent, and it is persistent to the present day, among many other maladies. There's also a really interesting and pretty rich historiography, although situated really in this sort of slice of African history that is very interested in health and healing and medicine. So one of the seminal works is Marianez Lyon's book on the Belgian Congo and on Belgian interventions. Other scholars of Congo have picked this up over time. So Nancy Rose Hunt talks about it in Colonial Lexicon and others subsequently. And so there's a vein of research that is really interested in understanding sleeping sickness prevention and colonial rule. Kirk Hoppe has a wonderful book on Uganda and looking at Uganda. And there are sort of studies that have been really focused on how individual regimes, colonial regimes, engaged with this problem of sleeping sickness. And also of the tsetse fly. Clapper Mavunga has a great book about the tsetse fly. So there are these sort of national histories that look at national or sort of pre-national colonial histories and the way that people in those spaces and at those times engaged with sleeping sickness as a problem. And it was generally understood to be an economic problem and a problem of labor, because if you got it, you died. Right? So this isn't a disease that you recover from by and large. It's a fatal disease. There's one variant of it that it sort of presents more chronically and can kill people over a series of months or years. There's another another variant that can kill people very, very quickly. And so the important thing in terms of the historiographies of sleeping sickness is that we've really tried to understand how sleeping sickness control measures fit into colonial rule and the elaboration of colonial public health systems. So that's sort of one piece of it. There's another piece that looks at how these epidemics arose in the first place and tries to connect, and successfully, I think you could argue, connects changes in density of cattle and density of farming, where people are living and working prior to the advent of colonial incursion and colonial rule, and then during colonial rule, and understands the different transitions that were brought about as part of colonization and how those exacerbated the spread of sleeping sickness.
Wow. Sorry, did I?
No. Go ahead. go ahead. There's a follow up. Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. I was just gonna, having said that, mm-hmm. having had that set of conversations mm-hmm. Clarified. You can finish detailing that, and once you're done, if you want to, you can tell us a little bit more about the cases that you chose,
sure.
How these cases, you felt that these cases could speak or enrich those conversations.
Yeah. The thing that I'm working from notes, and so I just glanced down, and in terms of the intervention that I was trying to do in this different literature, or thinking about how I fit into the historiography. And I think one of the key things that is significant in these broader histories of sleeping sickness is that there was really important fundamental work done to establish the relationship between colonial incursion and colonial economic imperatives and the spread of sleeping sickness, and really wonderful work that has also connected sleeping sickness as a way that different colonial administrations, but also different populations, sort of engaged with their environment in different ways, engaged with medical research in different ways. Guillaume Lachenal has a wonderful new book out about French Equatorial Africa and these mass drug campaigns. But most of what we had talked about, in large part, generally focuses on the period where there were biomedical treatments developed or public health approaches that were that had been sort of delineated that were controlling this disease in a particular way. So when sleeping sickness is known to be caused by a parasite and known to be spread by the tsetse fly after sort of 1902, but the fly stuff takes a little bit longer, then you have these really, really ambitious and draconian public health initiatives that kick into gear. But I was really interested in what happens in that time period where things aren't as certain, right? And if this is an illness that is emerging in people's lives as a cause of sleepiness and as a cause of death, if it seems to be operating at a new scale, people are talking about that. People are trying to make sense of it. And the people who were affected by sleeping sickness were African populations. There were a scattered few Europeans who end up getting sick with it or dying of it, but we are looking at African mortality by and large. And I was really interested in understanding how people made sense of what was going on in their world. And I realized that as we talk about sleeping sickness, it's posited as this, when it is discussed, it's posited as this really significant rupture. So both the disease and responses to it are this really significant rupture in African history and African lives. But there had to be continuities reaching backward and reaching forward in terms of how people managed this crisis, managed illness and misfortune, however they understood it. And I also was very clear, too, from the material that I was looking at in the archives, that even though these colonial public health campaigns were very ambitious and were trying to alter every aspect of people's lives, they were also full of holes, They were not perfect. People were negotiating with them and evading them and using the campaigns in these public health spaces in entrepreneurial ways. They were sometimes trapped by them and sometimes died in them, but sometimes came to work in them. And there were opportunities for social mobility as colonial auxiliaries, sort of coming back to those three men in the background of that picture with Robert Koch. And that was a story that I thought was really important to tell because it got at this moment of transition, both in ways of understanding illness and ways of thinking about causes of disease, but also in how to address what was happening within a community. And that was the space that I really wanted to fit into in that rich literature of sleeping sickness work and the history of sleeping sickness, was to think about what it was like when things were not so certain. And what can we learn about African intellectual worlds, ways of ameliorating misfortune, ways of healing, ways of ensuring prosperity, particularly within the Great Lakes kingdoms, by understanding this moment of transition as a moment of transition, but as a moment of connection over time.
Excellent. So to speak a little bit about this moment as a preamble to the specific case studies, I wonder if you could just, for the listeners, very quickly let us know, or not as quickly as you need to, don't feel rushed, just give us a sense of that transitional moment. You know, what is the colonial setup at this mm-hmm. particular moment that you're looking into?
Sure. So specifically focusing on the Great Lakes region and on the lake shores of Lake Victoria and Lake Tanganyika. So that was the space that I was interested in. And I was interested in circulation around and across the lakes. Uh-huh. So in the early 20th century, in 1901, when for these first reports of a sleepy disease, a disease where people are weakened and wasting and falling into sort of coma or have these disrupted sleep patterns where they're awake or manic at some times and sleeping at others and then die. So the reports of this disease start to come out at Lake Victoria in 1901. There's circulation of the disease, of reports of the disease in the Belgian Congo as well at the time, what was then still the Congo Free State. So what is happening in Eastern Africa is that the Uganda Protectorate is very, very young. So the British have made more deliberate moves to claim territorial control of the northern littoral of Lake Victoria and are expanding through war and negotiation into what is now modern Uganda. Likewise, the railroad has been built from Mombasa through to Nairobi and gets to Lake Victoria right at around the same time. And at the same time, the German administration, although historians debate on how enthusiastically and how reluctantly, the German administration is also expanding westward from its base on the coast at Bagamoyo and Dar es Salaam and elsewhere, expanding westward to get to the Great Lakes region to claim territorial control of Lake Tanganyika and its lakeshore. This is sort of post-Berlin conference, post-formalization of most colonial borders, but still at a point where the European colonial presence in the interior of Eastern Africa was mostly a military presence, was sort of limited outposts, very few civilian personnel. And those that were there were, I think, really precarious, certainly in Eastern Africa, in German East Africa at the time, as well as the Eastern Belgian Congo, a little less so in Uganda because there was a historic missionary presence, French Catholic and Protestant Anglican missionaries were there and a sort of more bustling town in Kampala in Uganda at the time. So that setup was one where the transition to civilian rule was happening, sort of from the 1890s to the early 1900s, which meant that officially this era of conquest from the perspective of European actors was sort of drawing to a close, the pacification process that happened. And so that meant that in some ways, European administrations are sort of settling down to the business of ruling through civilian apparatuses in this space. And then here comes this epidemic. So one of the things that's really central in the, in this moment is that the production of knowledge about African populations by European actors happens in the course of these public health investigations or of these medical investigations and public health campaigns. So one of the things that is in the book a little bit, but that was really striking in the long arc of things was that starting off, when you have people going out to European doctors, colonial officers trying to go out and figure out who's sick and how sick they are and what they're sick with, they can't even find anybody because everyone just runs away. They just leave their homes temporarily. And these European doctors have very scant knowledge of local languages. They don't know where they are. They can't convince people to let them approach because they're accompanied by colonial soldiers who everyone is concerned about. And it's a mess. It's a mess. And so it's in that period of transition that they start to rely really heavily on local auxiliaries in northwestern Tanzania, in the kingdom of Kiziba, which is the second set of studies. There are really explicit efforts to engage with the Omukama, the king of that region, and try to sort of find a way to train and work with auxiliaries who have the imprimatur of royal authority. And in Uganda at the same time, in Buganda and on the Sese Islands, there's an effort to try to kind of insinuate European research expeditions into existing missionary medicine, to try to get people to trust them and to work with them and so forth. So that political transition, I'm really glad you asked that political transition is a really important transition as well that parallels this broader transition within research in biomedicine. Now, but again, that's the sort of European perspective on how this would have looked. What we understand is happening within the interlacustrine kingdoms in Buganda and the Seses in Kiziba and in the Haya kingdoms and likewise on the lowlands of Lake Tanganyika, is that some societies have been visited by a series of really significant disasters in the previous decade and a half. So cattle diseases came through and affected differentially different communities, but generally devastated cattle and ruminant populations. There were epidemics of smallpox. There were particularly bad year for locusts happened at about the same time, paralleling military incursion from these colonial authorities, right? So that by the time we get to 1900, 1901, we have populations that have really experienced a significant amount of disruption, but are also sort of still working within existing political systems and existing healing systems to survive and to thrive and to prosper as best they can. And again, into those communities, here comes sleeping sickness. So it was really a moment where a lot of things were changing.
Yeah, definitely. So let's dive in a little bit into your, sure, your studies. You start with the Sese Islands. You know, tell us, you know, just a little bit about, you know, situate the Sese Islands. I found it incredibly, one of the things that I found very, very interesting is situating these sort of, I guess you would call them kind of like marginal, they're not marginal, but in thinking about the politics, mm-hmm, of Buganda, you, mm-hmm, know, how they're like in the periphery of this sort of state that, of which we tend to know more, mm-hmm, and how to some extent, like you were saying, that that sort of internal politics played a little bit in how people from the Sese Islands themselves had, you know, how you were saying, those transitions and those ruptures between how they used to deal with issues like disease and other cases of misfortune. So I guess if you could tell us a little bit about the Sese Islands, its relationship to sort of the larger politics of the area, mm-hmm, and how you tell us that story of strategies and ideas to make sense of misfortune.
So thank you. So this essays are a really fascinating place. This archipelago of 80-some islands that's in the northwestern corner quadrant of Lake Victoria. One of the things that's really interesting, and here I draw on some wonderful ethnographic and anthropological research, as well as historical research. The Sesses had been really central to the advent of the Ganda Empire and to the growth of the Ganda state, because they had boat building and navigational expertise. So they were in a subordinate relationship with the Ganda state and the sort of powerful and expansionist Ganda state, but were also really really a pivotal part of that state's expansion across the lake and out into the area. At the same time, the first sources that I read about this history were missionary diaries, were accounts from scientists, particularly from Robert Koch. I sort of followed his journey on a sleeping sickness expedition around Lake Victoria. And the Sesses emerged as this focal point in Eastern Africa because mortality from sleeping sickness was perceived to be absolutely devastating there. Now, we know now from a variety of different research looking at mortality and looking at famine and crop failure, that not all of the people who died likely died directly of the infection with the trypanosome parasite. They may have died of other things, but there's a sort of convergence of disease and death that was perceived by German and British actors to really fall on the Sesses with particular severity. So I was interested in, as I sort of looked at the narrative of sleeping sickness control in Eastern Africa, of understanding what was going on the Sesses themselves, and tried to situate the Sesses not looking out across from the mainland, across the lake to this archipelago, but really sort of landing in place and thinking about what the Sesse perspective and the perspective of kind of Ganda landholders who had presence on the Sesses and vice versa would have been about this dramatic change. And one of the things that is also durably important about the Sesses is that they are home to the shrines, and they are connected to the powers of the most powerful deity, Mukasa, who has a variety of different names in Great Lakes, in different Great Lakes societies, to this deity who is the god of the lake, but also a deity that is responsible for fertility, for health, widely invoked by a lot of different people at the time as they went on journeys, as they sort of went about their lives. It was also, because it was such a powerful place within the politics, the sort of political and ritual power of the Ganda Empire, as well as the Ziba Kingdom in adjacent Kiziba, it was also a place where the missionaries were very active very early. So we have this documentation and a sense of what the Sesses were culturally for people living around Lake Victoria, but then also this interesting documentary base of missionary writings, travelers' writings, sort of people collecting information that then you can read strategically to understand what life was like at the time. So the Sesses were also, you're right, peripheral relative to what we usually think about with Buganda, but absolutely central for understandings of sleeping sickness at the time.
Excellent. So tell us about those understandings. What do people in the Sesse Islands think about this disease? For what you could discern in the sources, how did they seek to deal with it in this what might have seemed like a new iteration? Did they see it as a new iteration
of illness? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that's really interesting about this
this sort of problem of thinking about how people understood what was happening to them when they were getting sick is a problem of sources and language and what things are called, what you name things. And so one of the things that we can understand from the historical sources is that this sort of sleeping death was something relatively new in this place at this time. And in part, that's because we see that it is characterized as being related to a deity that brought illness into populations, Kaumpuli, who a lot of people will translate as the god of plague. So it's the god of plague, but it's a lot more complicated than that. But eventually came to call this sort of sleeping, nodding death Mongota. And that is derived from a Ganda word that that describes that glosses sleepiness or nodding or falling asleep. And one of the things that I found about what people were doing was that they were doing something. I mean, so at a very basic level, I should say that the way that we have generally talked about sleeping sickness doesn't really address any kind of responses among the people who were affected, other than maybe that those deaths were reported to political authorities, but we don't really talk about what they did. And one of the things that I found in the book was that people undertook measures to separate the sick from the well that had been used in past experiences of diseases that they saw as spreading, of illnesses that they saw as spreading. So the sick who were sort of seen to have this kind of sleepy affliction, which people recognized to be serious and potentially deadly, they were set apart from family homes, ultimately settled together so that family members could care for the sick, but also sort of distance that affliction from their own home and hearth. And so that was one of the first things that people did to kind of make sense of what was going on. One of the other things that happens is a fair amount of mobility and different kinds of treatment seeking and therapeutic efforts. And one of the things that's important about the Sese Islands, again, with the Mukasa Shrine there, as well as a well-established Catholic mission and then a Protestant Anglican mission there, is that there are really diverse therapeutic resources for people to avail themselves of. So there is, on the one hand, the really significant ritual resource of the shrine and of the mediums at Mukasa Shrine, but then also the Catholic mission and the White Fathers mission at Bumangi, where the White Fathers, where the missionaries of Africa were really interested in dispensing various and sundry medicines to people when they could. They had a hospice where they would feed people. Now they're interested in saving souls and they're interested in conversions, but they're not really as they don't want deathbed conversions. They don't want emergency conversions, right? They want them to be genuine and sort of durable. So there's a relationship with the community there, but also a resource for people as they fell sick. So we do see some increasing use of or sort of increasing prevalence of the use of these missionary resources. They count the number of sick. They're tallying the people who are coming into the hospice and recognizing that they can't really do anything for people and they can't save them, but they can maybe make sure they have the food that they need if their families have already died, you know, and so forth. The Anglican mission was evacuated from the islands, in 1905, I believe. And so the Anglican mission is not a resource for people thereafter. And they had not been as interested in general treatment of various and sundry maladies. They were interested in kind of connecting with women around the care of their children. But that was a bit of a different dynamic. So at a baseline, what happens on the Sese Islands is that people start to very assertively seek therapies, seek treatment, seek amelioration of this disease, and also deal with this concatenation of illness and death that is sort of
spreading throughout the communities on the Sese Islands, because the Seses are a place where there's tsetse habitat along the lakeshore that gets sort of increases over time. And people are being bitten by the flies as they go to and from the lake, and are around on the islands, as well as if they travel on the lake into different lakeshore environments. So the disease is spreading. And that's one of the things that happens. Now, another layer to this, because it's sort of layer upon layer upon layer, amidst this crisis, arrives Robert Koch and this delegation of German researchers. And they are there explicitly because a lot of people are dying there, and they want to do research on trypanosomiasis, right? And they want to find, Koch especially, really wants to find a drug therapy that can be broadly used for trypanosomiasis. He had been chasing therapies and therapeutic research since his work on a treatment for tuberculosis in the 1890s. So he is there and brings this well-provisioned expedition into the midst of this crisis to do research on sick people at this camp at Bugala.
And if I remember correctly, very clearly detail how, to some extent, the notion of layers is really interesting, because there's this notion that he understands that he's not going to apply this on a blank slate. You know, he tries to make use, and to the extent that he's successful or not, at least in the layout of his attempts, he makes very successful use of existing knowledge and existing ideas. So tell us a little bit about how he achieved that, or what is it that he made use that worked for him, at least in the long term, in the short term.
In the short term, yeah. Because that's the other thing about this. It was relatively short in the grand scheme of things. He was there for less than a year. So Koch is a very entrepreneurial guy. He's famous late in life. He's gotten money from the German government to do this expedition, and he's negotiated with the British to do that research on the Sese Islands. But he's also experienced enough to know that you need resources, and you need connections, I think you could say. And so he situates himself in the abandoned buildings of the Anglican Mission, which is not an accident at all. The buildings are the church and one of the mission buildings are more secure places for him to keep all of his expensive technical microbiological apparatus. He's within walking distance, although a bit of a long walk, from the White Father's Francophone Catholic mission, sort of along the ridge of the island. So they have Christmas dinners together. They know each other. Two of his scientists are housed with the White Fathers, and he and one other one stay at the Bugala, the abandoned Bugala mission, which had been an Anglican mission. And so he sort of weaves himself and weaves his expedition directly into those extant relationships with other European actors, and really solicits the help of the missionaries to kind of convince people to come in for these experimental treatments. And one of the things that is really important to emphasize here is that all of the treatments that are being offered at this time are experimental therapies. The main drug that Koch was working with, and that other researchers had worked with at different times within the preceding few years, is a drug that's derived from arsenic, known as atoxyl. And it has impact on the optic nerve and can cause both temporary and permanent blindness, as well as sort of pain and injection at the sites where it was injected. The drug is primarily injected at this time. And so Koch is trying to develop an experimental therapeutic protocol, right? A drug protocol with a drug that some of his colleagues have said is not going to work. and actually has side effects that are detrimental enough that really we shouldn't be using it, even though it was the drug that a lot of others were using. So sort of the challenge for the expedition is to get enough people who are sick with sleeping sickness into their camp space at Bulgala, which means they are given a number, their symptoms are assessed, they're kind of brought into this laboratory discipline, and then to give them doses of this experimental drug and then follow them to see what happens. So he needs people to be close by, and he needs to be able to keep track of them, and he needs to and he needs to be able to assess the impact over time of using this drug. So being situated in space and having people who are sort of attached to his camp and to the missions is really of paramount importance. And that's this very strategic decision to situate the expedition in this particular place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So how does this work that he ends up doing in the CESS ends up informing the other sites that you investigated?
Yeah.
You know, you start with the Kiziba and then with the Haya area.
So one of the connections between the Sesses and Kiziba is actually a very long-standing political connection between the ritual power that's situated on the Sesse Islands at Mukasa Shrine and the royal royal authority in Kiziba. And so we know that there has been connection between Kiziba and the Sesse Islands, people moving back and forth across the lake for some time, but also that sort of as the Ganda state takes a greater and more powerful role regionally, that Kiziba is a tributary state, sort of similarly to the way that the Sesses are. So, but we know that there are people, fishermen from Kiziba, from coastal areas of Kiziba, that have been going to the Sesses and have been marketing their wares around the lake. And so Koch identifies a set of people who are living in a fishing camp on the Sesse Islands who are from Kiziba. And because Kiziba is in German East Africa, not in British Uganda, this is something that's very important for his work as well, because one of the things the expedition that he's on is supposed to be doing is addressing the spread of sleeping sickness southward from Buganda and Busoga along the Lake Victoria lakeshore into German territories. So again, this kind of anxiety about the spread of the disease. And so Koch sends one of his research assistants, a German colonial military officer, colonial medical officer, rather, who had been seconded to the expedition, a man named Robert Kudica. He sends him to Kiziba to do some investigation about whether the disease is really solidly established there, and to assess what kinds of prevention measures might be possible. And one of the things that's important about the sort of legacies of Koch's research, on the one hand, that he doesn't ever get the therapy that he wants. Etoxil is a bust, and it blinds people, and it's very harmful. But the idea of the camp and the isolation camp is something that becomes durably important and is incorporated into German strategies, as well as becomes a part of the British strategies. Now, the idea of an isolation camp, of a lazaretto, a quarantine station, is a very, very old one historically. But deploying those kinds of stations deliberately to try to capture and to contain and to understand sleeping sickness was something that was a kind of process in development at the time. And so that's one of the repercussions for Koch's Sesse work, is this idea of a camp where you could bring people through the camp, diagnose them with sleeping sickness, give them injections of etoxil as a prophylaxis, right, as a preventative for the spread of further disease. And the idea that if you gave people a little bit of etoxil, it would reduce the parasite load in their bloodstream. Again, even with its harmful side effects, this is what they were willing to do. And so it's in that way that then Kiziba becomes one of these outposts within the German sleeping sickness campaign after Koch's departure. So there's one at Kigarama in northwestern Tanzania, one at Kishanje, also in Kiziba, and then another near Shirati on the eastern shore of the lake. And then another station that's not really a camp, but that is sort of functions at the near the modern town of Mwanza.
But Kigalama is the one that really becomes the kind of flagship research site in Eastern Africa, in northwestern Tanzania, for the German campaign. So that's how they get to Kiziba and to focus on Kiziba, is through these connections that are sort of born of epidemiological observation, but also related to historic mobilities. But it's right on the border with British Uganda. And so if we think about borders being really important for colonial states, less important to the people who are living within them, right? But being really important to colonial states, you know, that border location is really front and center for the Germans in trying to contain the spread of the disease and to understand the nature of the spread of the disease. But again, things do not go as they plan.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting that in a way, by pinpointing the, like you said, the continuities between these different communities, but also the differences, for instance, in comparing Sese to Kiziba, like you identify these individuals, the gland feelers, I've noted down, you know, it's like, which again points to the idea that while people in the Sese, for multiple reasons that you have already detailed, might have been initially more willing to voluntarily go to these camps, that eventually was not necessarily the case in Kiziba, you know, that they needed to be more coerced or like encouraged, you know, to go to these camps. Can you tell us a little bit more of that, the role that that these gland feelers had to play in convincing people to seek treatment or subject themselves to treatment?
Sure. And one of the things that you've identified as an important baseline to think about when we think about public health campaigns, people avail themselves of different treatments and different strategies at different times for a variety of different reasons. And so one of the things that I was grappling with in this research was that you saw people coming in for a variety of different reasons, but then you also saw them leaving. Okay. So people come and they go, and understanding how they come and they go is a really interesting challenge. So I was looking at the statistics and the records of the German Sleeping Sickness Campaign, which are held in archives in Berlin. And I could see that there were people who were listed as coming in, and the doctors would record their age and their provenance and information about them. And then you would have a listing of the people that died and what they died of. And then there were other people who were listed as anderweitig, which means otherwise, elsewhere. And I thought, well, who is going elsewhere and how did they do that? Isn't this supposed to be a closed system? And so one of the things that was really crucially important for the camp at Kigalama early on was the relationship that German doctors developed and sort of tried to cultivate with the Mukama at the time, who had come to the throne in 1903, whose name was Mutangarwa. And Mutangarwa had already, as I discuss in another chapter of the book, had already had a relationship around health and around disease surveillance with regard to bubonic plague in the area, and had seen how the colonial interest in disease surveillance could be used to one's advantage politically, I think, within internal Ziba politics. And so so he is, and this is one of the ways that he ascends to the throne in 1903. So Kudika, who has some Swahili, but no Olohaya, no Ziba, is working from Kigalama, where he chooses the site based on the fact that there are a lot of sick people there. And he can't get anyone to stay in place for him to figure out who is ill, unless they are so gravely ill that they can't get away. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so one of the things that he decides to do is to work with, sort of solicit Mutangarwa for a cohort of people who could assist with those local considerations, who would know the landscape, would know where people were located, could communicate directly with people, and then could bring people from their homes when they were sick or with signs of sleeping sickness, bring them to the Kigalama camp for investigation and diagnosis, and ideally keep them there for injections with atoxol until they were then released or left on their own. And this is this cohort of gland feelers. And gland feelers is a direct translation from the German. They were called gland feelers because one of the manifestations of sleeping sickness was perceived to be these enlarged cervical lymph glands on the back of the neck, which were called winter bottom sign. So Kudika trains these cohort of young men, probably in their late teens, early 20s, to go and to search for sleeping sickness and to note the names of the sick, to report about the sick, and then to bring the sick back, usually with the help of Askari or of other Ziba political officials. So it's this effort that really deploys colonial, the sort of trappings of colonial power. They're likely given some clothing or some sort of goods that signify their attachment to the sleeping sickness camp. But they're also, I would argue, really visible as a cohort of an age set that is attached to the royal palace. So they're also men of the king as much as they are people associated with the camp. And so even though they're young men. And I've said, you know, before that usually when you're looking at public health campaigns and you're trying to train people to go and to go out into communities and to do the work, you're sending people who are really neutral, right? Older women. You know, the modern polio campaign in part deploys young girls to go and to do some of that work because you don't want anybody who's going to cause any trouble when they're going into someone's house or to be in any way sort of alarming to the people who you want to talk to. And I have said, and I say this to my students sometimes, like a cohort of college age guys is not your first choice, right? Of people who are going to lead neutrally into these spaces. But these are young men who have been trained in statecraft at the palace, and they're really firmly attached as a moteco, as an age set group. I would argue they're really firmly attached to the throne. And they are the ones who go out and do this work of surveillance and of kind of collection of people who then are supposed to come to the Kigarama camp for diagnosis, sort of shaping this prevention campaign as well as greater knowledge of the extent of the disease in place. But they're really complicated figures. It's clear that there are counter negotiations going on, you know, and that sometimes people are passed over or that they're seen as not deploying that power of surveillance and of coercion neutrally, right? They're valued initially as being people who are really steeped in local knowledge. And, you know, whenever colonial officials are talking about local knowledge, it should be a red flag, but they're steeped in that local environment and they're valued for that. And then over time, the extent to which these men are intertwined with this community becomes a detriment. You know, they know too much. They're too susceptible to counter arguments, to counter payments, to other ways of doing things that would also, you know, speak to the desire of a family member to stay in their own home when they were sick, or to not be separated from loved ones, you know, to get these painful injections at this camp that was increasingly viewed with skepticism over time. So they're really interesting figures, but very complicated figures in this process of public health surveillance.
Yeah, definitely. It sounded like a situation that speaks precisely to like you said, the difficulties of the very specific political setting in which you're trying to operate, and which may or may not encourage people to avail themselves to certain treatments. Mm-hmm. So your last case, the Southern Imbo among the Haya, tell us a little bit about what these last case added to this rich history of sleeping sickness.
Yeah, the book traces roughly the sort of transitions in the German colonial anti-sleeping sickness campaign in Eastern Africa. And German East Africa at the time encompassed modern mainland Tanzania, as well as Rwanda, modern Rwanda and modern Burundi. And so so the area in Lake Tanganyika is peripheral to the Rundi state and the Rundi monarchy, but is also really people who are living on these lowlands along Lake Tanganyika are also connected across the lake with the eastern fringes of what was by that time the Belgian Congo. And this is where the sort of cross-lake mobility that operates prior to and around and through colonial borders and state rule is something that's really important. So it's connections across the lake east-west with the lowland towns and trading centers between modern-day Ujiji and modern-day Bujumbura that are the focus of that last case study. And that's in part because that area is understood by the German government as this hotspot, and a major concern with regard to the sort of eastern periphery of the German East African state. What we learn there is, I think, something slightly different than the other two case studies, because there's a lot of new information being assimilated and integrated by everybody involved at the Sese Islands and in Kiziba. Tactics are changing, policies are changing, approaches to therapies and healing are changing. And with the IMBO campaign, which is simultaneous to the work at Lake Victoria, but sort of is elaborated slightly differently, we see the system of camps being put into place from the very beginning. Right. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that characterizes the campaign on Lake Tanganyika is a chain of sleeping sickness camps and outstations and treatment centers that are spaced roughly evenly along what is now the Burundian coast of Lake Tanganyika, but also extended further southward into what is now Tanzania between Ujiji and points south on the lake. So these treatment stations are really meant to be catchment camps where a German colonial officer will sort of establish themselves, try to surveil the area around them and the population around them, bring people into this atoxyl regimen, but also importantly, systematically deforest the lakeshore to try to destroy tsetse habitat. And so it becomes a space of significant labor requisitioning. Mm-hmm. Whereas fly habitat clearance was really not taken on board as a broad policy in northeastern Tanzania, in Kiziba, it's one of the keystones of the Lake Tanganyika campaign. And so so this case shows us how understandings about disease sort of fit into approaches to environments and spaces, and the kind of conflicts that arise between the people living in the Imbo, sort of Rundi and Bwari, Congolese, and other populations who are circulating back and forth across the lake very vigorously, despite German intentions to get them to stop. But looking at sort of looks and tries to understand how those populations, which had their own distinctive cultural milieu, interacted with these new impositions from the German state to try to get them to do the work of clearing work, as well as sort of stay attached to these camps and circulate through these camps for atoxyl injections.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier, for instance, that sleeping sickness continues. It continues to be mm-hmm. an issue and a problem. Having written this rich history of these early attempts to address it on the part of colonial authorities, what have you concluded in terms of what these tell us about how those attempts to deal with it have evolved, progressed? Where are we today in those attempts, and more generally, what do you think we can learn from this history?
That's a great question. One of the things that is, I think, important but also complex is that some of the tactics that are developed to control a vector-borne disease like sleeping sickness, like malaria, that we have that are oriented around preventing mosquito bites or oriented around fly habitats and so forth. Some of those tactics that are broadly environmental in their approach are still with us today, but they have their origins in historical ideas about people and environments and ways that things can be controlled, some of which are early ecological arguments, but others of which are just about sort of managing environments so that people can live in them. And I see some continuities between those sort of earlier moments and desires to manage disease and the way that things are playing out in the present day. So sleeping sickness is still a disease that is fatal if left untreated. Great strides have been made in the last decade or so for drug treatments for this disease, but it is still a disease that's difficult to diagnose, difficult to treat. Most of the treatments have significant side effects, although that's changing a little bit now. But it was also a disease for which there was very little interest in developing drug therapies for most of the 20th century. One of the main drugs in use in the 20th century had such significant side effects that it was really dicey when to use it and how to use it because it could kill you. And that's directly related to who was getting sick, which is to say Black African people were getting sick and there was no market for a drug to treat them, right? Mm-hmm. And I think we still see this sort of idea of people's lives being valued in different ways by drug markets, by development of research and science. That's one of the things that I think is a really important lesson to derive from looking at the history of sleeping sickness, is that that there are diseases that have been known, that are known to be deadly, that are known to be a significant cause of mortality and of sickness, that have significant economic impacts. And they haven't been prioritized because of the people that are getting sick with them. And that's the sort of my new project is about the so-called neglected tropical diseases, of which sleeping sickness is one, and ideas about their eradication and elimination. So that's one piece of it. I think the other thing that we have to keep in mind when we're thinking about historical disease dynamics, and one of the things that was really an animating idea for me with this book, was to think about how public health interventions are situated. And I think it's important to step away from the passive voice actually there. So I'll amend that a little bit, to think about how people situate public health interventions in particular places and in particular communities and what they expect will happen next. And this has to do with colonial public health, certainly, but also with national public health programs in the present day. And this sort of tension between what's happening in a local community and how that operates and how it impacts your outcomes. One of the things that became abundantly clear in the course of looking at sleeping sickness research and sleeping sickness prevention and how people interacted with it was that the specific circumstances and immediate histories and people's experiences prior to the advent of this particular form of disease, but also just in place with a given space or site, were hugely influential in determining the fortunes of that place. And so I think one of the takeaways for me when we think about how public health functions is to really encourage those who are designing public health interventions to think about the politics of where things are located, who are your trusted community partners, what are their interests, how do they diverge, what are the reference points for a target population when somebody from outside or someone from an elite background or someone with a particular message comes in and asks them to change their behavior in a particular way, right? And we know that these histories and these reference points are important for how an individual or a family or a whole community engages with a public health intervention. But that was one of the things that I really wanted to point up, is that we can see these things playing out very clearly in diverse contexts historically in Eastern Africa, but it should be information that gives us pause when we think about any kind of a community public health intervention, any sort of appeal that you are making that happens within a sort of living political and social space. So that's one of the other things that I think is an important takeaway.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think timely one too.
yeah, absolutely.
So you mentioned that your current project, just to, you know, start to wrap up a little bit, tell us a little bit about this project that you're working on right now, or, you know, any projects that you're working on right now.
Sure. So the project on the history of sleeping sickness in the early 20th century led me to a new project that I'm currently developing on the history of the neglected tropical diseases. And I sort of put that in quotation marks because the category of the neglected tropical disease, or the NTD, is a really powerful category in modern global health practice. So it's both a category that has very particular operative meanings around disease eradication. They're incorporated into the Sustainable Development Goals and have been a point of advocacy and action for the last decade or so. But they're also a really interesting imaginative category. So what does it mean for a disease to be neglected? Neglected by whom? Why? In what way? I mean, certainly the cohort of diseases, which range from trypanosomiasis, from sleeping sickness, which has been a neglected tropical disease for 40 years, or a neglected disease for 40 years, ranging from very well-known illnesses like this to loiasis, African eyeworm, snake bite envenomation is a new entry in this category. So I'm working on the history of these neglected tropical diseases, kind of thinking about the colonial legacies of a tropical disease, but also what is it that catalyzes in the 1970s interest on the part of international health organizations like the WHO, but also philanthropic organizations, the American Rockefeller Foundation, and others, to start to pour money and to advocate very strenuously for treatment of parasitic and neglected illnesses. And that story, which is a post-colonial story, it's a story about sort of geopolitics in the 1970s and 80s, but that has repercussions for the way that these NTD programs are going on in the present day, is what I'm currently spending a lot of time with. But one of the things that's also really interesting is that, you know, spending so much time thinking about parasitic diseases in the history of health, you know, in the earlier 20th century, I could get my mind around most of what the researchers were up to and what they understood was happening. But to move into modern molecular biology is an entirely different task. So one of the things that's really interesting about this work is very important to communicate about this project is sort of what is it that is changing in knowledge about immunology and about parasite resistance and so forth. And so another thing that I'm working on in parallel to the book research and to an article and some other collaborations is I'll be doing training in parasitology and epidemiology and public health starting in 2021 as a New Directions Fellow, an Andrew W. Mellon Foundation New Directions Fellow. So I'll be going back to school to learn how to deal with this in a better translational capacity as a historian who can also speak to scientists. So I have a plate that is like full of parasitic diseases, which nobody else would probably like, but I'm very excited about. And so that's the new project is sort of uses sleeping sickness as a springboard to think about the politics of disease in the present day. And I've also got some collaborations with colleagues at Pitt around how we understand health data about the neglected diseases to sort of operate and how it might engage with and be informative of modern health interventions. And so sort of trying to take this broad sense of all of these big changes in the 20th century in history, both in the history of health, but in the history of political change, and kind of bring them into dialogue with the modern research and public health and science and global health practice. So that's the next, I don't know, probably decade of my life.
Well, you know, we very much look forward to talking to you about that next project. If it's in 5 or 10 or whatever many years, I'm sure we were all, me and all our listeners will be more than excited to hear about it. Well, thank you very much for talking to us today. I very much look forward to hearing more about your work. And I'll let you go now.
Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure. Wonderful.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.